So, good afternoon. And, this is a busy day, Sunday afternoon, Amravati in the summertime. Family camp ended this morning, and all the happy families that have been engaging in the summer camp are leaving, going back to their various homes, and then the people that come and go and change, and then the monastics that stay, and we kind of watch the comings and then the goings. That's a metaphor, isn't it, for spiritual development, really, to really develop that attitude of awareness of the guests that come and go in your mind. And through that, then you become aware of the host, the one who's witnessing and stays, who's always here and now, and then the various guests that come for a visit and then go away. So this is all your thoughts, your emotions, habits, sense of yourself, your ego, conceit, pride, personality, views, biases, fixations, obsessions, and all the rest. They're the guests that come and go. And then what remains is the state of pure attention, pure awareness, mindfulness. And to realize that is the aim of the holy life. I think in any religion it would be the same, because it's, you know, just maybe in different words and different ways of expressing this, ways of contemplating it. But in terms of direct experience, you know, of when you're not particularly taking the convention, the religious convention, and just thinking about it, but you're actually using it to develop this awareness and this spiritual realization, then this is what you realize. And it's very simple, but it's not easy. We tend to think of it simple and it's easy, but it is simple enough. It's the ultimate simplicity. It couldn't get more simple. But in terms of being easy, we're not simple enough. We're too complicated. So that we endlessly create a network of complications around almost every moment of our lives. And so more than what it is. And things, you know, always thinking about the future or the past or this person or that person or hoping or regretting or whatever, then these are the complications we lay on to the present and completely overlook the reality, ultimate reality of the present moment, of the present conscious moment. So the subject, lonely in a crowd, loneliness is such a common human experience, isn't it? It's such a basic kind of emotion that we all have. This sense of loneliness, of being alone. And it's such a frightening experience that we, you know, we spend a lot of time trying not to be alone or continually complicate our lives so that we don't feel this. When we're young, we usually, you know, we're always going out into the world and to seek adventures and have experiences that make us feel we develop a sense of ourself as a person, as a member of a society, a member of a family, as a male or a female or whatever, and then we become very attached to these conditions, these identities that depend on reinforcement, on affirmation, on everyone agreeing to the same principles, the same attitudes, the same biases. And then when we're alone, and these confirmations are not around, and then the doubts arise, and the sense of needing somebody, of feeling vulnerable, of feeling lost, of being nobody, not being anything, being like the something that kind of exists and just like a leaf in a storm blown about by the fates. And so security is very, what we demand from our lives is a sense of security. We don't really want too much change or too much challenge or distraction that is alien or foreign or different from what we're used to, because it throws us into the state of uncertainty and insecurity again. It's interesting, I remember when I first read about, years ago, I think in the 1950s, when I started reading, when I was old enough, I was in the 40s, reading, old enough to read novels. And at that time, this novel called From Here to Eternity had been published. And it was, I think, one of the first adult novels I ever read. I'd been reading children's books up till then, like Silver Chief Dog of the North and that. And suddenly I had the challenge of reading this book, and there were all kinds of four-letter words in it. And kind of adult subjects that were quite fascinating. I felt really interested in reading adult novels. But the thing that that really impressed me at that age was the hero, the kind of was incarcerated in solitary confinement for a long time. I remember that, and he had this mystical experience as he was kind of locked into a cell and lived all on his own in a cell. Without anyone, I think the food was passed through the door, and that was it. And yet his kind of spiritual realization took place in his prison cell. So that young teenager, well, that impressed me for some reason. In that point of where you're really put in a situation where you are alone and there's no escape, where you're forced to be with yourself, and there's no possibility of anything else. And then this mystical experience happens. Then a few years later, I saw this Japanese movie in the 50s. I think the Japanese art films were very popular with young university students. And this one was about a samurai, kind of wild, undisciplined samurai, young samurai. He's just completely over the top and completely, a nuisance to everybody. And nobody knew what to do with him. He's a troublemaker. But there was this one Buddhist monk, Zen master, who recognized the spiritual potential of this wild man. And in the end of the film, he finally captures this man and locks him in a cell. And the man, screaming and yelling, cursing and ranting, but he can't get out, and something in him kind of recognizes that it's in that, that actually the Zen master is to be trusted. It's like breaking a wild horse. You have to tie it up and let it go wild as it's tethered, and then eventually it gives up. Then it is a horse that can be trained. Well, we're like that. We're pretty wild creatures, and all the complexities of our ego and the modern privileges of, say, middle class existence, the kind of high tech and materialism that we enjoy, they don't really lead us toward anything very profound. We tend to become increasingly kind of mediocre and kind of bland and vapid kind of personalities. Because we don't have tests or challenges or anything to our life, but merely kind of maybe endurance, just patiently kind of getting through it, but through endlessly distracting ourselves. So and loneliness then is something that we aren't really faced with that much, and because we can have a television set, which helps to keep the mind occupied, or there's all kinds of, you know, the internet and and you can always, you know, contact somebody and distract yourself into something, some interesting thing that's going on in the world. And so these opportunities, like being locked into a cell, incarcerated in a prison, then there's that Chilean or Argentinian writer Borges, a fantastic, beautiful story about this kind of fantasy story about this. He was the reigning king of some Aztec or some American Indian civilization, and he had this huge kingdom, a beautiful capital city with palaces and wives and all the best, you know, in that style. And then the Spanish conquerors came and locked him up in a cell. There's another one locked in a cell, and over the years, in the next cell, it's so dark in his cell that all he can see is the next cell. There's a couple of bars that separate his cell from the next one. There's a tiger in the next cell, and so he spends all he somehow assumes that if he can solve the mystery of the tiger's stripes, then he would have supreme knowledge and could then make his escape from this cell. Now he spends his life watching through this kind of flashing glimpses of this tiger that's pacing back and forth in the next cell. And finally, after many decades of contemplation, he discovers the mystery of the tiger's stripes. And then he realizes that what he knows now, he could completely liberate himself, and he could get back his kingdom. He could get even with the nasty Spanish conquerors. He could get everything back: his youth, his health, everything that he lost. He could have it all back just by repeating this formula that he learned, the secret from the tiger's stripes. But it ends with, "But it's not worth it," he said. "I just spend my days something about letting my ego disappear, something to that effect, you know, just totally relinquishing recognizing the importance of this simplicity, rather than trying to get back into the thick of it all, into being the king, the conqueror, the emperor, the great man, the wealthy one, the one that everyone's envious and jealous of." So this is an image that, you know, that of course I think many of us draws us into monasticism, is this image of the solitary, the recluse, the hermit. And because it is something in us resonates with that image. It's some kind of maybe archetype. I can think of like Buddhist monk is almost like an archetype in the human race. Something, you know, it's not just a cultural kind of old-fashioned way of dressing yourself that we've you know, we're so attached to tradition, we insist on not changing anything and holding on to these old kind of robes, shaven heads, because of some kind of strong allegiance to an ancient Asian tradition. One can, that might be the case with some, but for me, the value of it lies in it, in the fact that it seems more archetypal than traditional. It somehow resonates on a deeper level than just being an interesting costume or some curious Asian religious habit. So, anyway, that's just how I experience the appearance of the samana, the shaven-headed, saffron-robed spiritual seeker. Loneliness, I think, is something that when we contemplate just the existential experience of being having a human body and being conscious, is that basically we are alone as an individual being, and that's just the way it is, because in terms of experience. Everyday, ordinary, mundane, daily life experience is that one's always here in this position, and you come and go. You know, you'll come and then you'll go, and this body will come and, you know, eventually go back to my caravan and that. But there's always that which stays. Whatever the body, it doesn't leave. You know, and it's always aware. And that's completely in terms of the experience on the conditioned plane of being in a society, being with others in a community or whatever, is this experience of aloneness, where you're always with yourself, even if you're incarcerated in a prison cell, or you're in the middle of a crowd. You're still, there's this, the crowd comes and goes and changes and moves around you and affects you, you know, it irritates or aggravates you, it affects conscious experience, but basically the experience is of the knowing, being that which is aware, that which is experiencing, that which the conditions around are impinging, pressing onto the senses. And the conscious that we experience as consciousness. So loneliness is also, or aloneness is when we take it on the personal level. This is where it gets anguishing, and we feel grief and loss and fear and desire rising out of loneliness, is because we take it all on a very in a personal way. The whole social, cultural conditioning of the mind is an affirmation of ourself as a personality, some kind of personality. The society kind of constantly reinforces this sense of our belonging in a community, being part of a community, rather than being the center of the universe. Now, being the center of the universe, that may sound like megalomania, you know? And it could very well be, you know, if one took it as an egotistical position. But in terms of experience, that's the way it is, isn't it? Each one of us is the center of the universe. I mean, from the time you're born, you have to, you know, the conscious moment that you're experiencing right now, within the limitations of your human condition, is that that's the center of experience. Everything is coming at you so that surrounds you from, who knows, from, you know, the astrologers say we're continually being affected by Jupiter and Neptune and Pluto and things like that. And certainly, you know, it's certainly not impossible when you contemplate that this is a conscious form in a universe that has no limits, as far as we can possibly conceive of limits. There's no limit. It's infinite, and there's so many forces, so many, and it's so vast. Being infinite, it has, and everything is affecting us in some way. And when we take it personally, then it, you can see why we find it's so frightening, and in a way it's dreadful, because it's too much for the human mind to bear on that level of trying to imagine or contemplate all the various forces that are affecting us at this moment. So with mindfulness, we're not trying to fathom the all the possible varieties, permutations of conditionality, refined and coarse, seen and unseen, that could possibly be affecting us at this moment, because it's beyond our ability as a human being. But we can be aware of what of the way it is in the present, in terms of the mental state you're in, physical, mental, emotional. That is within our ability. And then we can see how we react to each other, how different people, just the way they look at us or don't look at us, affect us. Just the way somebody walks has its effect on our consciousness. Isn't it? They walk in an aggressive way. You know, you find yourself just physically kind of feeling, you know, drawing back. Or somebody looks angry, you know, and then you feel it, you know, even though, you know, maybe they're not even angry at you, but they look angry. And we say, you're angry with me. We can see it as you are angry with me. Or you are... Your aggressive act, body language is something, you know, aimed at me. We can interpret everything in this way, on this sense of me and mine, personal experience. So like paranoia, and that is definitely that illusion, isn't it? That delusion of interpreting all the threatening things that are within human experience. And taking it all in a very personal way. Like I met one time in Malaysia, a paranoid man came to stay with me, and we were in this remote place in Borneo. You know, that's a pretty remote island, and I was even a remote part of that island. And then I took him for a walk into the little village, and then he said, you know, there were CIA all around. I had been there for 2 years. I hadn't met one CIA. And I said, oh, really? I began to think, how can I get rid of this guy? Obviously, he probably saw me at CIA eventually. But this is, like if someone just stood and looked at him too hard, and it was some, you know, American agent. I said, well, what is it that you have that the American government wants? You know, it costs a lot of money to pay all these agents to just spy on you all the time. So, the reason didn't seem to get to him, or the sarcasm. But he developed some game that was superior to chess. The American government was after it. But But that is taking the experience of life, and always in this, you know, the American, the CIA, the KGB, the whatever it is, they're always, you know, aimed at you, the whole universe is there, you know, terribly interested in what you're doing, what you're up to. Well, that's an extreme, whereas mentally ill, you know, whether you're so convinced that this is reality, but that you never question it, you're totally committed to that belief. But in the spiritual life, then even if we do have tendencies towards those kind of thoughts, then we begin to see them in terms of guests that come and go, or thoughts that arise and cease. Because that's what they do when you're actually aware in the present. Even a paranoid thought is, you know, that the CIA, how many of you are CIA? even such a thought, if it should enter my mind with mindfulness, then to see it as something, you know, I'm experiencing it, it affects consciousness. But this transcendent awareness is the refuge that I take, in which it is totally accepting, totally knowing of the condition, but it's and it's not judging, it's not making some kind of psychoanalytical judgment, saying you are a paranoid schizophrenic tomato, or that you are, you know, something wrong with you for thinking everybody in this room is CIA. But it's transcending that kind of judging. It's not judging, but it's noticing the way it is, that thought, no matter how maniacal or crazy it might be, is something changing. And if it's present, then through patience it disappears, it ceases. And in that way of reflecting, then we begin to release the interpretations of life in this personal way, not trying to get rid of them, but they no longer have the impact and the validity they have when they're never questioned, when they're totally believed in, and we operate from the I am, me and mine views or attitudes. So taking it to the very center of experience, or the still point of awareness, of pure awareness, pure mindfulness, then all that, the conditioning of the mind is seen in terms of guests that come and go. Ajahn Sumedho, me and mine, the emotional habits, the whatever they are, you know, how skillful or unskillful, mature, immature, good or bad, useful or useless, they're seen not through judgment but through wisdom as impermanent conditions, guests that when they're here they feel like this and then they go. And when they're gone they're like this. And that which knows then, this knowing in the present, is then, say, rather than being a sense of loneliness, it's more like what they use at one-ment, or the Christianity of atonement, or at one-ment, where this sense of merging, of where the one is universal rather than personal. You see, so then the whole feeling of loneliness as a person then is seen as in terms of an emotion that as a guest that arises and ceases, but not as something to hold to or to get rid of or to judge in any way, but just recognize it. As a condition, as a Dhamma, as something that is the way it is. So in the mystical experience, mystical union in terms of Christian mysticism, or in the realization of Nibbana in Buddhist terminologies, then it this is this realization. It's not, but in it's not terms of oneness as a metaphysical doctrine, because the Buddha definitely tried to avoid metaphysical positions, because he was very much pointing to a kind of a realization, a practical realization, rather than a metaphysical position of his for his teaching. So it's not a, and this is where many people get confused in regards to Buddhism, because we oftentimes feel that, I mean, if you take it, you know, you try to analyze Buddhism from a Western conditioned mind, you usually, it ends up being very kind of nihilistic or annihilationist, it seems, because it's not affirming a metaphysical doctrine of any sort, but it's pointing to a realization, which is a metaphysical realization. It's a transcendent realization. And that realization is always here and now, timeless. It's not dependent on conditions. It's not something that you create or that you find, but as you begin to relax, let go, and trust in just the simple act of awakened awareness in the present, then you, in that simple trust and faith in awareness in the present, then the mind, your mind is in a very receptive state where you're in touch with pure universal intelligence rather than conditioned knowledge, cultural conditioning. Getting out beyond cultural conditioning or education into a universal wisdom. So what this is saying is pointing to that this wisdom is something that we have. It's something that we say, as we begin to trust more in it, then we start using it more and more. The simple wisdom, it's not like complicated wisdom. It's not, you know, really difficult and convoluted kind of thinking. It's basic to the present. This Buddha pointed to the conditioned as arising, ceasing, as not self. Pointed to the unsatisfactoriness of the condition. Like all conditioned phenomena, is always there's something wrong with it. Every condition. You know, even at its, you know, it reaches peak. Conditions reach a peak, and then it's at its best. At its peak, every condition is at its best, at its peak. But then it changes, you know, it doesn't stay there. So there's always something wrong in the conditioned realm. There's always something wrong with every, you know, with the sense of yourself, with other people, with the society, with the world. There's always something. There's always something wrong with the convention, with Buddhism, with Theravada Buddhism. There's always something, you know, doesn't quite resonate. It's something that you don't quite like, or you've got, you don't quite agree with, or you can't, you know. So that this is just the limitation of conditions, isn't it? That all conditions are, say, dukkha, or unsatisfactory in themselves, because they contain like the mother Kali image. You know, she gives birth and she consumes what she gives birth to. and time that gave doth now his gift confound. You know, so he's got this, everything time-bound is kind of born, and then it's eventually kind of consumed, taken back, destroyed. So this is the realm of conditioning that we're witnessing to, not in terms of judging, but in terms of experiencing it, knowing it, examining it. And this is in like with meditation, this examination of conditioned phenomena. Is not judging it in terms of it, you know, saying that if it's impermanent and it's not self and it's unsatisfactory, that it, we just kind of dismiss it. It's not a dismissal or a negative. We're not creating a kind of aversion to it, but we're studying it, knowing it, feeling it, recognizing it, realizing it, so that it no longer deludes us. We're no longer taken in by it. We're no longer fascinated by the peaks of experience, nor are we destroyed or shattered by the failures of the conditioned realm. Because in that pure state of awareness, we're transcending the condition, the fact that the condition is something that comes and goes, is seen from this. Actually, when you're in that, when you really pay attention and learn to sustain and rest in that attentiveness to the present, then you're actually, that's the transcendent. That's where the realization is that which is here and now, the reality. But as long as we're not mindful, and we get caught up into liking, disliking, and trying to get more of this and get rid of that, and making judgments and plans and fussing around all over the place with the conditioned realm, and we're just, you know, even though the Dhamma is now, we're completely making life into a complicated issue, like the wild man, the samurai in the cell, or the Inca king that's locked in the dungeon. Eventually, through giving up to the present moment, the realization comes. So how can we do that? Do we all have to be locked into dungeons? And so this is a challenge, you know. And I've often wished somebody locked me in a dungeon or a cell, because having seen those kind of films and read those kind of stories, I got a romantic idea of it. Wouldn't that be nice? And then, and also, it would somehow make it easier, because in life, say, in a community, for example, like Amaravati, you have so many kind of things that trigger off, that stimulate the ego. And so you're in your emotional reactions are being set off very much by different people and what happens and the events that one experiences in a community. So then the challenge is how to use this within that, but as if one was in a prison cell, locked in a dungeon, and without all the this is where monasticism helps, at least if you use it in the right way, where you're kind of trimming down your options a lot. You become a monk or a nun, things that you can do are restricted, considerably restricted, and that help to create this this sense of restraint or incarceration or limitation placed on action, speech, behavior. But even then, there's enough. I mean, like now, monks have computers. There's nothing in the Vinaya about computers. And you have Dharmanet on the internet. I mean, it's Buddhists, you know. They keep in touch with world events, world Buddhism. You can get into internet Dharmanet. I hear I'm on the internet. I don't even know what this means. I don't know anything about computers. But you can't, even though, like when in I find now after all these years that by training oneself in the discipline more and more and relinquishing, then the actual the sense of simplicity increases, so that the basic trying to not complicate life, and you see that you know, like over the years I've experienced so many things, I've been in England for 21 years now. So I've been here for 21 years a monk, or in Thailand. All the complications of life, coming to England, say, increase the complexity of being a monk. I mean, because of you're outside the system, you know, you've got a kind of, you're not in Thailand, you're right within the system all the time, in the society, in the structure that supports it. So, and then your intimidation of being in European country as a Buddhist monk, where there's so much kind of, you're here to spread the Dharma. I mean, really good things they want you to do, and to spread the Dharma, be a teacher, be head of monasteries. People constantly want me to say, when are you going to build a monastery in Germany? I say, well, why don't you come and ordain as a monk? And then you could build a monastery. Why do you want me to do it? Canada and then Russia and then where you name it, they get all kinds of invitations, you know, and one feels sympathetic, you know, and understands the goodness behind it, but also it can, you know, if we're not really clear in our mind, then we can get kind of whirled away with good intentions and good works to the point where the simplicity is lost, and we're constantly attending meetings and doing this and raising funds and going here, and it becomes a very complicated, distracted life. So then how to develop that is, and now you have, as lay people, you have to contemplate in your own life how to develop your life in a way that you're simplifying it rather than continually complicating it. Now this is not to think that you should, not to give any kind of advice on how to simplify, but or even suggesting that you've got to simplify your life, but encouraging, trying to encourage you to contemplate the advantages of simplicity, because I'm sure you're all aware of what complexity is like. You know how frustrating, how stressful it is to have so many things on your mind, have so many options, opportunities, so many responsibilities, so many problems, so many issues, so many of this, so many of that. You know, it just becomes so unbearable that we break down, we feel stressed out. So simplification, to put it in modern jargon, is to chill out.